You are listening to the Screen Slate podcast. I'm your host, John Derringer, and on this episode, I am thrilled to speak with the team behind How to Blow Up a Pipeline, a new eco-thriller based on Andreas Malm's nonfiction book about sabotage and property destruction and climate activism. In this fictionalized story modeled after a heist film, we follow a group of people from disparate backgrounds who get together to build bombs and demolish oil infrastructure. On this episode, I am joined by many multi-hyphenates, director, producer, and co-writer Daniel Goldhaber, actress and co-writer Ariella Behrer, editor Daniel Garber, and co-writer Jordan Scholl. We cover a lot of ground, from their approach to adapting the book, to the research process, to shooting 16mm around the country on a low budget during COVID-19, and some of the initial responses and reactions to the film, among a whole lot of other stuff. I want to give a hearty shout out to all of Screen Slate's Patreon supporters. This podcast is 100% backed by our Patreon members. We don't have a secret oil benefactor. We don't have that Ford Foundation money. Everything we do is enabled by the generosity of our listeners. So you can visit patreon.com/screenslate. Throw us a few bucks a month. You get access to the Discord that myself and our writers and other Patreon members are on, invites to special events, promotional discounts, and more. So that's patreon.com/screenslate. And with that said, it's time to blow this shit up. Welcome to the Screen Slate podcast, How to Blow Up a Pipeline team.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for bringing the pipeline into the office.
Oh, yeah, totally. Thanks for coming out to Screen Slate HQ. So we have two Dannys. We have Daniel Goldhaber and Daniel Garber, who have collaborated on many films. In fact, one thing I wanted to ask you about, maybe this is a good way to start, is that the film is credited to all four of you as a film by. And could you talk about that decision?
It was just a typo, actually. No.
like John Derringer.
Yeah. This is, I think, a good time for you to air your gripes that your name is spelled incorrectly.
Let's clear it all up front. It's cool. I'm honored. That way, I have like plausible deniability if the film is, you know, canceled. Which it won't be
now. No, I mean, I think that movies are made as collectives. They're just rarely credited or recognized as that. And, you know, also the collective effort that it took to make this film goes far beyond even just the four of us. But I think that something that started with my first film, Cam, was, you know, that was a movie that I made with another filmmaker, Issa Mutsay, and that, you know, through that process, you know, we were just thinking a lot about, we were making it in this very collective effort, and like, how do you kind of communicate that collective effort? I think that we have this really flawed notion that the director is the auteur and is the sole visionary of a film, but often that's just not the case. I think that's totally the case sometimes, but I think that it doesn't have to be. And so I think, like, in this film, you know, a lot of us wore multiple hats, but I think that ultimately at the end of the day, the thing that I think was shared between the four of us is like, what is this movie? What is the identity of this film? What is this film saying? And, you know, I think that it just was very clear by the end of post-production that, like, this is what it was. And that, you know, that doesn't mean that many other people didn't contribute monumentally to the movie, from the other crew and department heads to the other cast members, but I think that, like, it was the four of us kind of figuring out, what are we saying and how are we saying it? I think it's been cool seeing people not just embrace that, but kind of draw parallels between the way the movie was made somewhat collectively and the story itself.
And how did you come upon the idea to adapt this book? I'm sure that's a very common question that you probably have great answers for.
Actually, the first time that we've heard it.
I should specify too, in case anyone's, you know, listening totally cold and doesn't know, this is based on a nonfiction book, which has been, you know, fictionalized and radically adapted in that sense.
Yeah. So the book first came to me. I'm also a grad student. I'm almost done being a grad student.
Oh, very congratulations. Close.
Thank you.
Yeah. Where at?
You got kicked out of grad school.
Plug
that's why.
Yeah, I'm finishing the program in literature at Duke University. Sort of program started by Jameson. So Verso books and the like are usually sort of in my attention span. And I think I was looking for something else on the website. I can't even remember what else. But you know, Andreas's book has this great cover and it's got this great title. So
yeah, I mean, I'll confess, I've totally bought Verso books on the aesthetics, you know, when they do the 50% off sale. It's kind of like the radical version of the Criterion 50% sale.
That's the business model.
Yeah, yeah.
They throw in a free ebook, you know, it's good stuff. It's great.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, it showed up and I went to LA to, you know, during height of COVID to one of the places where COVID was worst, which was a great idea, and potted up with Danny and Ariella, and I read the book and Danny read the book and Ariella read the book and we were all pretty excited about it. And I didn't pitch turning into a movie.
I have always been interested in making a heist film and, you know, my parents work in climate science and I kind of grew up with climate doom from a very young age and had always kind of wanted to tell a story about fighting climate change and about, you know, kind of environmental activism. And I think, you know, there's the combination of the book, its title, the politics, the ideas. There was kind of a light bulb moment of, you know, a bunch of kids in the desert struggling with a bomb. And I think that, you know, the basic idea of doing this is like a heist action process movie followed very quickly from there. We contacted Andreas. We started, you know, interviewing him, interviewing other activists he connected us to, spent about 2 months doing research. But it wasn't until kind of Ariella kind of cracked the opening 10 pages, which kind of put the ensemble together and also, I think, suggested a tone and an approach and a rhythm of the film that I think we actually knew that we had something.
Yeah.
And obviously throughout that process, we were talking with Dan. You know, I've been working with Dan for basically since I started making real movies. You know, it's been almost 15 years that we've been working together. We started talking very early on in this process and he went and bought the book. And, you know, so it was always kind of a collaboration in some form or another between the four of us.
Yeah. Ariella, do you want to talk about your approach to starting this first 10 pages and kind of coming up for the fictional framework for the story?
Yeah, I mean, we'd had a lot of conversations generally about wanting it to be a heist movie, wanting it to be very process-driven, and at the same time we were talking to pretty much any expert in anything that could help us make this movie and in turn meeting just so many interesting characters. And we had kind of talked about certain archetypes that we wanted to follow in this story, but we didn't have anything concrete. And I think I just kind of came in one day with like a list of characters, like 8 characters and their general story, where they would come from and why they would be here and all of their names. And I think the only name that's changed was Alicia since that one. That just kind of became a very solid foundation for us to make our process-driven heist movie. But I mean, even from there, we were still playing with structure. At first, it was going to be one flashback at the center of the movie, but we found that all of the discussions that we needed in the movie to, you know, appropriately adapt the ideas of the book wouldn't really make sense once you're already doing the act. So thus the multiple flashback structure was born, and we were just kind of rolling with the punches as we went, because it was just a really nonstop, breathless process of making this movie, and I think it's felt in the movie itself because of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of urgency to it. I think there's urgency, obviously, in the story of how do we address climate change. There's urgency to this particular mission they're on. There's even, you know, I would say urgency to the idea of making an independent film during, you know, COVID-19. I mean, I wondered if you could talk about choosing these different characters to focus on. You have, you know, someone who reads as vaguely sort of right-leaning, although I don't think that's necessarily clear in the film, teaming up with more like radical, younger leftist types. Was it important to you to represent a constellation of people and ideologies coming around a common cause?
I think the idea kind of started with us saying, what if it was us and our friends and we went and did this? And there was the version of it that could be about like whiteness and entitlement, like in this battle, you know, when the three of us are writing something, it is a predominantly white group. And then we kind of just very quickly realized that is the least interesting version of what we specifically want to do. We wanted a sort of fantasy heist movie that was invigorating and inspiring, and we realized we really needed to be true to like who would be on the front lines and who would be the most affected by this. And also, just truly, the honest answer is, if it were us and our friends, it would look like a group like this. A lot of the characters are based off of us and our friends specifically. So very quickly, when we started talking to people, these characters became who they are.
Jordan, do you want to follow up on that as well?
Yeah, we had started talking very early in this project, especially when we were looking at other media about generally, let's say, left-wing radical action, how there's this tendency for these stories to be stories of infighting and failure and defeat. And also, I think, as people on the left have seen a lot of infighting. And so part of wanting to tell the story was also telling a story of people coming together who might have different motivations and who might not necessarily agree about all of the finer points of why they want to do what they want to do, but knowing that they have the same goal. And being able to get together around the same goal and say, well, we can leave some of the other stuff aside. And I think to a similar end, Dwayne's character, who's like very close to my heart, I grew up in Wyoming, I know a lot of Dwayne's, is in part in the movie to be a little bit of a strike against this way that the environmental activism has been so separated into a left-right binary in this country, which is very recent and I think really stands in the way of people finding the other people who share their material interests and getting together and working towards a common goal, even if they have different beliefs underpinning what they want.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of wonder, too, I mean, I guess speaking of leftist infighting, you know, some people might say it's sort of like naive to try to tell a story in which people come around a common cause. Gerber, you look like you have something to say.
Yeah, I feel like that's just not, it's not really a criticism, because it's something that people don't say about so many other movies, so many other action movies in particular, about, you know, Marvel movies or like pretty right-wing movies like Top Gun Maverick or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's not as if people are coming out against that and saying, well, this is totally unrealistic. It's like, that's not really the point. I mean, of course, our aesthetic is way more grounded than a lot of other films.
Sure.
And so there is an element of realism in the aesthetic approach. But still, on some level, I think one thing that movies can do that a lot of other mediums don't do as effectively is make concrete and visible a version of reality that does not currently exist. And that's exciting and that's invigorating. That's one of the reasons that people go to the movies. Mm-hmm. So I don't really think that the fact that it's somewhat utopian in a sense is really a deficit in the film. It's actually, mm-hmm, I think, part of the design of the film.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting too that the way you talk about the film, it's almost like, you know, one could say a spoiler, and that you're very open about how you wanted to, I think, as you were saying earlier, Jordan, like, tell a story that has joy in it, or, you know, frankly, success.
Well, so much of Andreas's book, which I actually just was rereading because I've been doing some Q&As, and reading it, it's really joyful because he goes through these historical precedents. I mean, his point is to show that property destruction was used in so many of these movements that we've sort of sanitized in the way that we're telling them. But he goes through these movements and there is this real sense of like, look, it worked. Look, it worked. Look, it worked. There are things that can be done. And that story of success and that feeling of possibility is something that I think people in power would really like us to not feel right now.
So what were some of these conversations with Andreas like when you first approached him? Like, Goldhaber, are you the first person to reach out to him? Or?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the cold email. We just found...
Texting.
We just found Andreas's email online and emailed him and immediately got the most aggressive auto reply that I've ever gotten from somebody. It's just,
I like to throw those up from time to time.
Well, Andreas's are like, you know, I am on paternity leave. I will not be responding to emails for the next 3 months. Do not try to contact me. Like, I'm out.
And no, I've got a lot of respect.
Yeah,
for that.
And we were like, oh, damn.
Especially when everyone's virtual. Yeah. You know, it's hard to say, like, I'm out of the office when we're all in the office. So I'm just like, I'm not going to respond to your email. And like, just because I'm tweeting 50 times a day doesn't mean that.
And so, yeah, anyway, we were like, oh no, this is not, you know, this is not going to happen. And then a couple of days later, he responded and was like, this sounds awesome. I'd really love to meet. And we met with him and kind of, you know, walked him through our pitch. And I don't know if you've seen, you know, Andreas has kind of a very severe face and demeanor. And so, you know, I think he was in bed, like zooming at us.
He was staring down his stomach, like at the computer.
and we were sort of like Joe Biden photo.
Yeah. we're just
frowning,
just wetting
scowling at us.
And then we get through kind of our proposal of how we want to kind of approach this. He's like, this sounds great. Like, I'm in. Like, I'll put you in touch with Verso. Like, I totally get what you're doing. I love it.
Cool.
And he's been kind of just nothing but supportive. You know, he connected us with a bunch of activists and people in the space who, you know, added just like so much context to, you know, not just what the film should be, but how it should be that way and how we should be thinking about the film. And, you know, read a lot of drafts of the script. And, you know, his one big note on the script was that he didn't believe that we still had punks in the United States. And he wasn't sure that that was actually accurate.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but it was always nice to have this kind of, you know, philosophical and almost existential stopgap on the movie. You know, we always kind of knew that, you know, we could keep pushing the theory and you know, really refining what the movie was and be able to show it to him and kind of know that, like, you know, he would have a barometer check on whether or not we were kind of staying true to what the ideas were. And so he was always just like extremely supportive and extremely kind of helpful in kind of guiding us through that process.
Yeah, yeah. And had he seen Cam?
I don't know when he watched Cam or if he's seen Cam. I honestly don't remember if he ever watched
it. Just curious, yeah.
I can text him and ask him.
Yeah, yeah. Do it right now. No, I'm just kidding.
No, I'll do it.
Cool. Maybe we can put him on the phone. Yeah, no, I mean, that's super interesting. And I guess it also leads into the question of interfacing with different activist groups and like understanding this culture. How did you approach that?
Andrea says he did see Cam and that it's great with a lot of exclamation points. So.
Awesome.
Sorry to derail.
No, that was important. That process was one of my favorite parts of writing this movie. We were met with a degree of suspicion at first from people, but we generally just engaged so earnestly that I think those suspicions did not last long into conversations with people. And we very, very seriously took every note that we were given from activists. That was kind of one of the most important things for me. While I care a lot about making a good movie, and I think making the best movie is the best political thing that we could do for this movement, I also kind of had this mantra in the back of my mind the whole time where I could forgive myself if the movie's less than great, can't forgive myself if it hurts this movement in any real way. And engaging on that level, I think we were able to get some really lovely, productive conversations with activists that I continue to keep up with and am a big fan of.
Is there anything in particular that was in the script that, you know, you felt you had to change in response to a note? Not had to change in the sense that, you know, anyone forced you, but just had to, maybe that led you to rethink anything that you had written.
Most of this stuff, I think, was stuff that was like kind of architectural and infrastructural in the script. Like I think that the problem that a lot of people make when they're making movies or telling stories about things that are outside of their experience is I think that they'll like write a first draft and then show it to a consultant and be like, what do you think? And that's kind of assuming that somebody from outside the film industry is going to be able to give like great notes on a screenplay, which is like a very strange and bizarre document. I think that for us, like, and this was also the process that, you know, I have on Cam and that, you know, I've done other projects with both Jordan and Ariella and Dan now that, you know, I think that when you're doing work and you're doing research outside of your own experience, I think it's really important to start that research before you start writing and before you even know what you're writing or what you're, or how you're thinking about something. And, you know, I think that one of the reasons that we were able to build trust with people on this project is because we were going in saying, all right, we're going to adapt How to Blow Up a Pipeline it's going to be a heist movie in which people blow up a pipeline. What do you think we should do with that? How do you think we should tell that story? We don't know. Like, we don't really know what our way in is. We don't really know who these people are. We don't really know, like, what the narrative structure should be. And, like, I think one of the earliest questions we asked is, like, what is the worst version of this movie to you? What scares you about, like, how we could screw this up? And I think that that's the thing, is that we had all of those conversations before we wrote anything down on paper. And it was entirely just like open form. We weren't even really structuring the movie. We were just collecting ideas. And, you know, and then we were like taking that all into the shop and, you know, talking through it and sourcing through, you know, well, this person said this thing and we disagree with that. We disagree with what this person thinks about the film, but we really like this thing and like that thing. And, you know, this one person disagrees with something else this person said. That feels like that's a disagreement that would actually probably dramatically play itself out in the movie. And so it was kind of all of those conversations ultimately got woven into the script. And I think by the time we were writing, we kind of knew what we were trying to say and how we were trying to say it. So we didn't actually share the script almost at all with any of those consultants or those people, kind of across the political and ideological spectrum, you know, because I think that by the point that we were writing, it was really about trying to make it the best film possible. And I also think that we had enough eyes on it to keep it from being kind of politically treacherous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
They've all watched the movie, though.
Yeah, now they've all watched the movie. And
what have some of those responses been?
I hate you. Go to hell. Why would you do this to me? No, it's
actually, I mean, you mentioned earlier, like asking people what the worst version of the movie would be. Like, what were, you know, were there any interesting responses to that question? Like, you know, I don't know, having Rambo show up and like just shooting the pipeline or I don't know.
I think one thing we heard a lot was the version of the movie that feels finger waggy. That is, they blow this pipeline up and then that was a really bad thing to do and they have to be contrite and they have to pay their penance and they have mm-hmm. to, you know, I think that would have been exactly counter to what we wanted to do.
I mean, it's interesting too, like as you're saying this too, and I'm thinking about what kind of works well about the movie. I was thinking how everyone got really into Columbo during the pandemic, and you know, the whole premise of that show is you know who the murderer is, and it's sort of like the drama is like, how is he gonna catch him? And I think that's something that works really well in Pipeline. Is, again, you know, you've been fairly open about, like, the title kind of tells you what is going to happen in the movie, but it's the dramas and how you get there. I think that also speaks to the heist narrative, which you've mentioned. And do you want to talk about, like, certain films that are maybe outside of the, I guess, traditional spectrum of, like, radical cinema that you were drawing on? Like, maybe, you know, to me, it seems like Sorcerer and Thief are kind of like touch points.
It's so funny because the one movie that everybody mentions is Sorcerer, and the one movie that we didn't watch as a reference film and that we literally never spoke about while making this movie was Sorcerer.
That's crazy. Crazy to me.
I've never seen Sorcerer.
Wow. That makes two.
It's a total. It's a total like how to blow up a pipeline.
Have you seen it?
I have not.
I think. Well, what's
before.
I think maybe part of the reason, I think there are maybe two things that people are making that connection about. One is the way that the backstories are kind of woven in. Like, it's very much about, you know, a very specific task, but then you kind of weave in these backstories that go outside of that space and that timeline, which you do in this film. And then, you know, also I think Gavin's score, which is fantastic in the film, feels very like tangerine dreamy.
That was a thief.
Yeah.
We had a lot of Thief in the movie.
Mm-hmm. There was so much watching Michael Mann. I mean, often when I would get stuck in the edit, I mean, in the early days anyway, I would just throw on the first like 15 minutes of Thief and be like, all right, I've got my head in the game now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think another thing that Michael Mann does that's really interesting is part of his research process where he's talking to like cops and criminals. And I wondered if you could talk about that aspect of research in your film where you know, you're speaking to activists, but you're also speaking to like DHS people about, you know.
Well, like Michael Mann, we were just high on amphetamine the entire time. So that yeah. that really helped us
as
get into.
As long as you didn't kill any horses.
Yeah. No, it definitely was a cross-section of activists, academics, journalists, pipeline experts, and you know, yeah, we were very early on in the process, luckily connected to somebody who is a bomb expert, who is a contractor, who works in counterterrorism, and who is, you know, just somebody who is a giant bomb nerd and hates that bomb building is always extremely inaccurate in movies, who
sure, yeah, yeah.
wanted to help us get the details right. And you know, just kind of everything that's in the movie is something that you could put together with an intelligent enough Google search. But I think that he helped us. He just helped us kind of understand, you know, where would they source the materials from and how would they do that staying under the radar? And, you know, kind right, of just right. all of the little details, things like the way that Michael packs the blasting caps is like a fairly inside baseball kind of DIY solution to like packing blasting caps so that if you slip, you don't kill yourself or, you know, in his words, spend the rest of your life having your wife open your ketchup bottles. You know,
but also, I mean, even like a saying like that, which, you know, it's, as I recall, not in the film, but it's like that's the kind of context in color you get that you can only get from speaking to people like that. And yeah.
And this was also, you know, that particular expert is also somebody who is, you know, on a more personally conservative point of the ideological spectrum, and mm-hmm. with somebody who, you know, never read the script or anything, but absolutely we were thinking about in terms of, you know, the representation of Dwayne and, you know, how might Dwayne engage with these things.
Well, and also Michael as bomb nerd, like there was some affective stuff going on there too. Yeah, and there's something to just, I get it that it's exciting to build bombs after doing this, like doing all of this research and going through, you know, the Mujahideen improvised explosive handbook and going through declassified like improvised explosive handbooks from the U.S. military and everything. There are these ways that you start to see how these little small things that you can do yourself fit together, that you sort of get, like, I think going through this research process started to understand why people get pyromaniacal about
yeah
this.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, in
Jordan
a way it's
built
like,
all the bombs in the movie for real.
I'm glad to see you still have all of your fingers attached opening your own ketchup bottles. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, what do we all do in elementary school? It's like, you know, you put the vinegar and baking soda together and make like the little volcano, and mm-hmm. it's cool as fuck, and then next thing you know, you're blowing up pipelines.
I should say Jordan did not actually build any of the bombs in the movie.
Yeah. FBI did not. I mean, I was just kind of curious about, you know, pulling everything together, especially working on such a small budget and during COVID, which I think, you know, it's really challenging. This is something I hear from filmmakers a lot, but don't really see discussed online or in articles a lot, but it's just like how resource intensive it is to keep your sets safe and you know, both in terms of like the practical efforts and also the financial resources. So yeah, it just seems like mounting the production itself is this sort of pipeline-esque activity. And I wondered if you could talk about that.
Yeah, I would say most of the energy you get in the film was born out of pure necessity because of limited resources. I think it's like very easy to forget now that we have Neon attached that this was a completely independent production and we were rewriting scenes on the day just because we realized we did not have time for three scenes, make it one scene, you know? And I'm actually very grateful that that happened because it streamlined the ideas and it got everyone so focused and it was just pure passion being channeled into every minute of this movie. And I think you can kind of feel that when you watch it. We were very serious about the safety during the explosives and
And COVID, and we had the benefit of some help from a New Mexico program helping us fund some of our COVID testing, which was also a huge.
I didn't even know it was New Mexico. Project Indie Hope allowed us to make this movie because they sponsored and paid for the COVID testing. And
yeah, we would not have been able to make this movie during COVID on this timeline if our cast and crew were just punching the clock. The people involved in this movie cared about it, and that saved us.
We had virtually no COVID positives on this film.
Yeah, which is remarkable. I mean, I feel like everyone I've talked to has had some sort of shutdown or like having to, you know, quickly replace other crew members or get temporary replacements in order to keep shooting because of COVID.
We did lose two actors for one role to COVID, unfortunately.
Wait, is that true?
Yeah, that's true. None of the main ensemble, but we had...
They didn't die.
okay.
No, but we had an actor, I won't say it, who was actually cast for the FBI agent, who was like going to be, it was going to be a really cool cameo.
Oh, really?
And the day before we shot,
John Hamm,
her husband tested positive for COVID, and then we couldn't shoot with her. And then we cast another actor in that role, and then that actor got food poisoning, and then...
Damn. Not even COVID. Food poisoning.
I don't know why I said two to COVID. Yeah. It was one to COVID and one to a bad shrimp salad.
All right.
I'm also grateful that FBI plotline is what it is, though, and that it didn't become overly distracting by the cool cameo.
Yeah.
I think...
That was a much more significant... There was like a lot more FBI material in the movie that got cut out.
Yeah.
Just didn't have the time to... do it, and I think it kind of becomes the perfect balance now, while focusing on that more of the act and the main eight characters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, speaking of the actors, I mean, do you want to talk about preparing for your role? Also, I think you were the first actor we've had on Screen Slate podcast.
Really? Oh my God, honored.
No, it's a great honor for us.
I'm gonna put that in all my bios. That's cool. Huge. All right. Pressure. No. Preparing for Sochi as an actor was nearly impossible because I was so in writer brain. And we were talking about this today on set, where often I couldn't even process things until we were shooting it. But we also very intentionally were writing Sochi with that in mind once we decided I would be the character. Having sort of the author of the plan and the author of the movie be one became a way for us to comment on our own roles in this whole thing. Also, it became convenient that she was so constantly on the brink of implosion under stress, because that was me on set and in between takes off, and I'd have to go rewrite a scene instead of preparing for my coverage and then just launch into it and see how that went. And it became almost experimental, and it's really like as a process for me, it's not a way I've ever worked before, but it's kind of so interesting to watch it in hindsight. It was so raw. There was very little crafting of it that could be done until later, but it was really fun because of that. It was pure impulse in a way that I hope to carry with me in future work.
I mean, making the movie was kind of pure impulse for kind of all of us. I think maybe we had more time to think in the edit, but even then, the last, I'd say, 2-3 weeks of the edit, despite having worked very kind of methodically for several months, we like started just like cutting huge swaths of the movie out. And we cut close to 2 minutes of the film out in the last 4 days of the edit. And I think we actually cut a full minute out in the last day of the edit.
Yeah.
Or if not the last day and a half. There's like 90 seconds.
Yeah.
I believe you, but I've totally blocked that out. I have no memory of this.
Dan did like a 16-hour edit day one day, which is just, I think, virtually impossible for one's eyes and fingers. That was a tough one.
But it seems like you have so much moving parts, especially when you have this frame story and jumping back and forth with different stories. And, you know, because many of the characters in the film overlap, you know, personally, there are decisions you probably had to make about, you know, what, if this makes sense, like what is whose story? when you have characters who are like in relationships, et cetera.
Yeah, it's true. It's all kind of enmeshed, and it's a little bit hard to separate out the individual threads because, yeah, it is ultimately about this collective action, and building up one of the characters inevitably ends up building up the entire ensemble in a way. I think one of the things that was sort of strange about this edit compared to most others that I've done is that the basic identity of the thing and the basic shape of it was pretty much in place since the beginning. And I know we had all these worries about, well, will this sort of flashback structure even work at all? Are we going to have to fundamentally rethink how to structure this film? And fortunately, it did at least kind of work from the very beginning. At least it worked well enough that we saw a path to making it work as well as it does now.
Did you ever try a version that was like, you know, chronological? Or...
We didn't. Yeah. I mean, that was definitely something that was always kind of on the table. And just knowing how difficult it was going to be to pull that off, we ultimately decided that it didn't make sense. If it was somewhat working from the first assembly, it didn't make sense to scrap the whole thing and try a version that
it would be so
completely
funny
chronological.
To do it now as like an experiment and just see what happens.
Yeah, like the Gaspar Noé irreversible straight
irreversible
cut. Yeah.
Reversed.
I mean, I do have to give a lot of credit to all of the writers here who I think really thought through so many of these issues in the structure well before the footage reached my hands. So I'm happy that it worked so well to begin with. And I think that one of the struggles was that because it worked well enough at the beginning, there were all sorts of little things that could have been improved. Like they could have gone from fine to actually very good. And we weren't bumping on those things because people were captivated enough by the main experience of the heist that that it didn't force us into a position where we had to address those issues.
Yeah.
And so it was really at the end of the process, we were really being hard on ourselves and saying, well, this is decent, but could this be great?
Yeah.
That we actually started to make a lot of those changes.
And it's a funny thing with this process because it's true that like a lot of people like give Dan credit for like the edit credit for kind of the cuts, you know, back the flashback cuts, you know, which I think is some of the most obvious editing of the year in a way that's great and I love. But those are all of those cuts were scripted. And it's actually funny because the challenge of the edit was not those cuts, which were all fairly easy to make, but it was getting them all to work, I think, is the challenge. And it's kind of, you know, I think the biggest challenge that we actually had in the edit, when you have kind of a nonlinear structure like this that's still kind of working inside of this action genre, it's like getting all of the characters to be legible and getting all those backstories balanced pacing wise and getting all the information to work was really challenging, but also even just like receiving and decoding the feedback was really hard.
Mm-hmm. You build up to these great climaxes before you then cut to the backstory. And I think that's something, it feels very like punchy or something where it's just like,
yeah, totally. I mean, I think structurally, even though all that stuff was set, getting the exact pacing right so that people have a certain expectation that is then not fulfilled at the right moment, I think that that's really what the challenge
right.
is.
Like you're really the pacing invested in such in the a way. Action, and then it cuts, you know.
Right.
Like, oh,
right.
It's gonna
exactly.
Happen.
You create a desire or an expectation for the audience, and then intentionally withhold that, force them to sit through something else so that then when you get back to the main storyline, you can then fulfill that desire. And it's sort of like creating that sort of suspension and expectation that sort of enables you to buy the time for these flashbacks.
Yeah. Everyone's laughing hysterically.
Oh, God.
Do you have a more succinct answer to that question?
It's just that Ariella asked for the mic, and both Jordan and I knew exactly what she was going to say, and just started enthusiastically nodding to her, and it just said,
"No, I can't say it.
We just all spent too much time together."
It's just edging.
It's edging.
It is. I was really trying to like not use the word climax. I was like, but yeah, every word I could think of felt very erotically loaded.
Not to discredit any of the like brilliant work Dan. He obviously understands the technique and executed it perfectly. in the movie. Yeah, it's not just edging, you know? I would never take away the power of edging in this movie.
I think it's a skill, yeah.
It takes practice.
Yeah.
Edging master Daniel Garber. It's going to be the name of the episode, Edging with Daniel Garber and
the head other pipeline team.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's I will say that, like, associative editing, match cut editing is, like, one of the most, I don't know, it's probably, like, one of the most cinematic things that there is. And it's also, like, it's something that, it's, if you actually look at, like, a lot of what makes Spielberg great, like, an understanding of, like, associative and match cut editing that is kind of built into the shot composition and the narrative structure is like half of what makes his movies tick. Like, that man is a master of the transition.
And you also have these very like micro, I guess shouldn't say very micro moments, but like on more of a micro level. So not thinking structurally, but moment to moment of creating suspense around the bomb making and, you know, both the sort of patience and the detail that goes into it, but then also the suspense and the fear of, is this going to explode? Is this going to work? And could you talk about creating some of those moments?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. I think that a lot of it is about providing the audience with exactly the right information that they need to understand why something is suspenseful or why there is some sort of real risk to one of the characters. And so much of it is also about not giving them too much information. I think that there's a degree of being in the dark that is actually very helpful when it comes to creating that sort of tension. If you just have this ambient sense that things could go wrong at any moment, that's often more helpful than saying specifically, this is the thing that you should be worrying about. And so a lot of the editing, especially in the early days, was about figuring out what information to withhold, where to make the audience wonder what's going to happen.
I'm curious about the locations. Like, was it difficult to get permission to shoot?
We didn't have any. I mean, we don't need it. The shots in North Dakota were all stolen. The shot in LA in front of that refinery was just, we shot by the refinery. And then the valve station was the one that was kind of the diciest, but that was actually on the property that we shot on this big ranch called Diamond Tail in New Mexico. And that valve station is just on that property. And so we had the ability to shoot outside of the fence, just kind of based on our location agreement with the ranch. We started to get a little bit ambitious and we actually were like, can we get into the valve station? Because that would be sick. And so our location manager very enterprisingly called the company and was like, hey, we're making a movie about a pipeline being built. And then some kids come along and try to sabotage it. And there's a scene that takes place at a valve station. Can we shoot in this, like, you know, can we shoot the valve station? And they were like, totally not a problem. Really excited. Would love to support the New Mexico film industry. Would just love to take a look at the script. And then we'll like get into the approval process. And they never heard back from us.
Oh, man.
Very,
you could have whipped up like a, maybe like a short film script, yeah. You know?
We would have had to do what I heard that Kirk Douglas did when he made Spartacus, when he was putting together the all-star cast, which is that they sent a version of the script to every actor in which it appeared that that actor was the lead actor in the movie to get them to sign on to the film. Which is a brilliant idea, but we were so tight on production that we didn't have time to produce a fake version of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. No, it's crazy. I don't think I ever mentioned, I was like detained at a pipeline, or not a pipeline, an oil refinery once for taking photos. Cause like there's one in my, basically in my hometown, and there was like all this fire shooting out of it. And I was with a friend, and this was, you know, probably mid 2000s. We're like young, getting into photography, and we're just like taking pictures of this pipeline. And these two dudes showed up kind of like in your movie and like detained us and called the FBI. But I think part of that too just speaks to like the sort of post 9/11 moment. And yeah. So I was kind of curious if anyone like showed up and tried to bust you guys.
No, we also, there was like a little bit of weird attention in North Dakota, but nothing that I would say is like concrete. People like knew we were in town making a movie about oil, and we got some like weird looks and questions, but we were pretty lucky. And we were also lucky because there's some shots in Bakersfield that we went and got on a day of pickups, and we were also stealing all that. Like, I was literally, we were like, I was like hanging out a car window for that shot where it drives by the oil derricks.
Putting the camera through fence, like gaps in fences to get shots inside of the...
Like little montage where like the oil is shutting off.
We
got in Bakersfield.
Cool. So yeah, I mean, maybe we could talk about just the reception to the film, both, you know, what you've had so far at festivals and also kind of what you hope, you know, how you would like the film to be received.
I mean, I think younger people in general tend to respond very positively to it, and that's something that's been very gratifying. I mean, I think in a somewhat condescending way, sometimes people from older generations say things like, I'm so glad that your generation is going to solve all of these problems that we created. And and I find that really irritating. And I guess I would just, rather than making a film that sort of panders to older generations, I would rather have a film that really speaks to the people who are likely to be making change in the world. And if it resonates with them, then that seems like a major victory.
Right. And also people who are going to have to live through the worst of it, you know, which is, you know, really sad to think of, you know, the people who are fucking everything up are just going to like die. Not have to suffer any consequences. Yeah.
I mean, speaking of younger generations, there was this, we've been traveling a lot with a movie, and I did a film festival in Spain where we showed the movie to two groups of high school students that we had like two different screenings for several different high schools in the area. And it was so interesting. I mean, they responded really positively to the movie, and then there was kind of a Q&A after, and it was funny that at first the kids wanted to be kind of trolly kids about it, and they, of course, it was right after like soup had been thrown on paintings, and they had so many jokes about it. You know, which is fine, but then, you know, using the movie as kind of like a point of reference, we were actually able to have a really cool discussion about property destruction, and like kids ended up engaging.
I think that there's like a really funny kind of, I'm not accusing you of doing this, but there's this kind of like slightly leading question thing when people ask that question, where I think it's like they want us to be like, we hope that people go and do X, Y, and Z, and it's a call to arms. But I think that like what I really believe about, I think what we all believe about the movie is that like there does not need to be one desired response from any piece of art, and especially from a politically engaged piece of art. I think that the idea is, as Ariel is saying, like we're trying to ask a question. And that question is, in the face of climate apocalypse, what tactics are necessary and justifiable to avert it? And I think that there's not necessarily, well, there are plenty of wrong answers, but I think that the conversation, the cultural conversation around that is really important, and that there are hopefully way more than one thing that comes out of a cultural conversation and a cultural shift of confronting, you know, what an escalation of tactics means and how it can be, you know, implemented, and how, you know, activists who are currently on the ground today fighting this fight can be supported, and how the support of that fight can create new legal precedents that can, you know, allow us and enable us to, you know, force a move towards a different, more sustainable future. All of these things are related to each other. All of the kinds of, you know, more formal systemic change that we're looking for rests on the back of, you know, activists. And I think that understanding the fact that, generally speaking, we have been lied to about the legacy of social justice movements in this country and in the world, and about the place that sabotage and direct action has had in those, getting people to recognize that and think about that and empathize with that and making that tactile and immediate to our current moment, I think has a lot of value, because I hope and believe that people will take that and do stuff with it.
Yeah.
So a great reaction is going out and buying Andreas's book. It is good for consciousness raising.
Another great reaction is, with it. going and getting involved.
Yeah,
like getting involved. There are tons of people and organizations that are fighting this fight right now that are doing things that are extremely impactful and far less extreme than blowing up a pipeline, if that is not your bag, you know. And it's like, look at, you know, what's happening in Atlanta right now. There are a number of groups and organizations that are, you know, supporting the Cop City fight in Atlanta. Look into the case of Jessica Reznicek and Ruby Montoya. You know, look into, there are so many different movements that are probably, you know, in your own backyard. And I think that getting involved with those and figuring out how to wield your own place in your own life to engage with the movement is basically all that you can do as a person. And I think that we continually send this message that you need to do more than that somehow. But I think that that's a flaw. I think do what you can. And that's a great place to start.
Yeah. I mean, this would be a great place to end the episode. I am curious, though, to ask what the discussions have been like working with Neon when you sold the film. Like, typically, I think the way people approach marketing films now is like getting involved with various communities, like identifying which groups may be interested in the film. But there's also a slippery slope of like not wanting to exploit social justice movements. Yeah. And then also, of course, on a totally different level, just sensitivities around the potential, let's say, like political blowback to the film. Like, is Neon at all, you know, has there been any concern of like, oh, we're gonna, I don't know, if someone's gonna get mad, a right-wing politician is gonna get mad at the film?
I think to the first, you know, the rules that we had in the research process hold here. You know, we approach anybody that we're thinking of partnering with and say, hey, there's this movie that is related to the work that you're doing. How can we be helpful to you? How can we be a resource to you? How can we use our platform to help you? And you know, those are conversations that are still ongoing. It takes time. I think that as the movie gains more purchase in the world right now, we're all trying to figure out what those partnerships can and will look like. But I think for us, there's no real desire from the Neon end of things or from the us end of things to partner with groups to sell the movie. We would like to be able to point them in the right directions because people come out of the movie feeling energized. And, you know, it's important for us that we're directing them in places to use that energy in ways that are productive, but that also to do that, we need a lot of information. We need partnership. And also we don't want to, I think, ever make it feel or ever have it be that we're kind of inserting ourselves also into a conversation in which we don't belong. So it's about that kind of cooperation, that dialogue and that conversation. On the other side of things, I think that it's similar. There's absolutely no fear and no real concern about blowback or pushback. I think that from our perspective, conversation about the film is good. I think that it's just about the fact that we all need to feel like we can fully stand behind what the film is and what the messaging is and what the marketing is. And that is a conversation that, you know, again, is ongoing. You know, I really hope that, you know, 3 weeks from now, I don't have to write you, John, oh no, a piece of marketing came out that we didn't all align on. And, you know, now we have to disown that piece of marketing. But that hasn't been the case yet. You know, like thus far, it's been like an extraordinarily harmonious and collaborative effort in you know, making sure that we're doing everything we can to, you know, first and foremost, ask that question that you know, I kind of outlined earlier in a way that is entertaining and accessible and provocative. Like, it's okay to be provocative. That's the idea, is to provoke conversation and to provoke cultural movement, but you have to be provocative with a purpose. Yeah. And I think that we all have had a lot of clarity on that purpose. And I think that we just hope that we can continue down the path that we've been on.
All right. Thank you, How to Blow Up a Pipeline team. It's been a pleasure to have you at the Screen Slate compound. And yeah, we hope you'll be back in the future, and wish you great success with How to Blow Up a Pipeline, opening April 7th?
April 7th in New York, LA, San Francisco, Austin.
Portland and Seattle.
And then April 14th going wide across the country.
Whoa, really? Wait, like how many theaters?
They don't tell me these things.
Like, but like, will you be able to see it in Canton, Ohio?
You might be able to. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think I'm going to tell my parents. This has been the Screen Slate Podcast. I'm your host, John Derringer. I want to thank you for listening, and thanks to our special guests, Daniel Goldhaber, Ariella Barrer, Daniel Garber, and Jordan Scholl. And thanks to Kayla here for helping us set this one up. An extra huge shout out to our Patreon members for making this possible. If you would like to join them and support the show, you can visit patreon.com/screenslate. In addition to the Discord, special event invites, you also help us pay writers, maintain our online listings platform, keep the daily newsletter going, and of course, back the show. Last but not least, be sure to subscribe to the pod on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen. We are currently experiencing Podmageddon at ScreenSlate. We have so many pods coming up. Tomorrow we have another one with the great Kelly Reichardt, who needs no introduction. And next week we have yet another episode with Christopher Borgli about his fantastic new feature, Sick of Myself. Also, a quick plug, I'll be doing a Q&A with Christopher next Wednesday, April 12th at IFC Center at the 7:30 screening of Sick of Myself. So don't miss that. I think it's a really wonderful film that should definitely be on your radar. And so with all that said, thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow with Kelly Reichardt.